Hello and welcome to the HSJ Health Check podcast. I'm your host Annabelle Collins and I'm joined by Lawrence Dunhill and Nick Carding. This week we're talking about the saga of Greater Manchester ICS's financial collapse that saw the system go from being a very strong financial performer to ending the last financial year with a £180 million deficit. And at this very difficult time, in news revealed by HSJ this week, its chief financial officer has been seconded to NHS England. In other news, we're also discussing a leaked NHS England review that warned of a severe shortage of nurses and midwives with digital skills. But first, let's talk about Greater Manchester ICS. And Lawrence, perhaps a good place to start is your story from this week about the CFO. What's been going on?
Yeah, so we found out this week that the CFO of Greater Manchester ICB / ICS, Sam Simpson, has been seconded to a strategic role in the NHS England Regional Directorate. The official explanation for this is that it's to backfill for the Regional Finance Director, Nick Cashew, who is helping out the national team while still doing the regional role. And it means that the deputy CFO at Greater Manchester is now in interim charge of finance for the ICS. And it seems like a strange move because this is a particularly difficult moment for Greater Manchester and their finances. They are being pressured by NHS England to make further cuts on the initial plan that they submitted in March, which was for a £300 million deficit, which NHS England described as completely unacceptable. They've since submitted a plan for a deficit of around £200 million, which is also unlikely to be accepted. They're probably going to have to push for more savings. So it seems like an odd time to suddenly have the person in charge of your finances seconded to NHSC. The context, of course, is that, yes, Greater Manchester has been a strong performer over the last 10 years, but a lot of that performance was based on non-recurrent savings and the benefit of quite a lot of headroom in terms of cash balances that they could lean on. And then they set a break-even plan in 2023-24, but it's kind of quickly emerged in the year that wasn't going to be deliverable, and they ended up reporting a £180 million deficit. Throughout the year, they kept on publishing this quite kind of ridiculous graph where it showed their position kind of plummeting and their plan going along a flat break-even line, and then this kind of rather hopeful dotted line going up at an increasingly acute angle from the deficit position to the break-even plan, which people had a lot of fun with on social media. So then earlier this year, NHS England decided to start to issue enforcement undertakings to the ICB, which is it's a kind of legal mechanism which goes back to the days of CCGs actually, and is separate from the kind of SOF framework. It's essentially special measures, and it means that the GM has to make certain commitments about its performance going forward, particularly on the kind of financial improvement that it will deliver. And if he doesn't agree, or if the performance targets aren't met, then NHS England has powers to essentially sack the chief exec of the ICB.
Wow. And yeah, as you said, it's a really tricky time for someone to be leaving. Have you had a sense of why now? Why now is she being seconded?
I think to an extent readers will have to just make up their own minds about that. The official explanation is that Nick Cashew, the regional director, was seconded into the national team to provide some support there. He's still carrying on in his regional role, but they wanted to bring in some support for him because he would have less time on the job. And so they wanted Sam Simpson to provide that backfill in the regional directorate as a director of strategic finance, and that's the official explanation. And I don't think we can speculate any more than that, really.
Fair enough. So you said they're aiming for a deficit of around 200 million, which is unlikely to be accepted. So, but what are the sort of things they're going to be doing to try and save money? I mean, is there any more they can do? It seems like they're just in a really, really tight spot.
Yeah, so that they're now having to consider some pretty bleak things, whereas previously they would have tried to make workforce reductions without redundancies. You now see some of the trusts, such as the Northern Care Alliance, which we've talked about previously on the podcast, launching full-scale redundancy schemes for their corporate division. We also have discovered this week that they're going to have what they're describing as a systemic reduction in their reliance on private providers, which is important because Greater Manchester has one of the largest waiting lists per head of population in the country, and one of the largest proportions of year-long waiters. They've actually made quite good progress on the very long waiters, so the 65 and 78 week waiters in the last 6 months, because they were a real outlier on that as well. But they've done that by using the private sector a lot, and so by saying they're going to cut back on their private sector use, they're essentially admitting that finance is trumping quality at the moment, and patients will have to wait longer. Another really depressing thing they're considering is cuts to population health budgets, which are very precious in Greater Manchester, because they talk a lot about health inequalities and the underlying causes of some of the problems that the NHS has. And they're currently considering a 60% cut to their population health budget, and that they already made a cut of about around 40% last year. So this is pretty depressing stuff, because a lot of their strategic planning talks about population health and investment in prevention services as a way to be financially sustainable. So this is absolutely the worst thing they could be doing, but I'm assuming that they simply feel they don't really have anywhere else to go at the moment.
That's a really, yeah, as you say, a depressing number, 60%. And that's interesting because obviously the NHS has sort of been pinning its hopes on population health management. And, from a tech point of view, there's lots of they want lots of investment in that space. But if it's not, I'm surprised they're sort of cutting that when it's supposed to be part of the solution to the prevention work, so therefore helping with reducing waiting times and demand. So it feels like that would just be a completely short-term cut that would just, store up further problems later down the line.
Yeah, definitely. And it sort of goes to the short-termism again of NHS financial planning. But yeah, I think I will be asking some sort of questions of NHS England on this. Like, what, surely they should be given enough headroom to invest that full budget. I suppose NHS England may come back and say, well, yeah, they shouldn't be doing that. They should be making the savings elsewhere. So yeah, we'll see on that one. Hopefully they won't end up having to cut it, but they did last year already, so it doesn't seem that unlikely.
And a lot of systems, Lawrence, have been cutting staff numbers. Have they also been doing that? I know that some have been resisting, saying we can't cut anymore. I think in Staffordshire as well, there was kind of an ask or an expectation that providers would also cut staff. And I think it just seems like people are feeling like they just can't afford to lose any more people.
Yeah, I think they still do. So obviously, there's a difference between in the in management's mind, there's a difference between clinical staff and non-clinical, and certainly non-clinical staff in GM. I think will be those budgets will be under a lot of pressure, and like as with the Northern Care Alliance, who are implementing a 14 to 20% cut in their corporate services staffing budget and more than 100 redundancies. I think more of that is likely. In terms of clinical staff, I think they do still have some possible headroom on cutting the agency bill. And so they'll obviously go for that first, but before considering anything else.
And then just around the current leadership within the ICS, do you think that's going to remain stable for a while? Because I think often when people are kind of moving in and out, it can just make it really hard to get on top of a challenge this monumental.
Yeah, and that's why this secondment seems so strange. And the chief exec, Mark Fisher, also now has the enforcement undertaking sort of hanging over his head. And so I think it would all create all of this would create a kind of sense of instability, yes, which is unfortunate. And that is a kind of difficult environment to operate in. I think on the plus side, the key providers do have fairly stable leadership at the moment. You have Mark Cubbon, who's gone into Manchester Foundation Trust, and he's had a good year or so there now, and is quite settled and is pretty well regarded. Owen Williams at the Northern Care Alliance has settled in well there, and again is well regarded. Karen James at Tameside and Stockport is extremely well respected, has been there a long time. So that's on the plus side. You do have some impressive people in the big providers.
Does make me wonder though, wonder if no one else was available for that post in NHSE. They would have thought there might be other ICS finance chiefs that maybe have been in better financially performing ICSs recently that might have been more of a logical candidate for the NHSE strategic director regional job, but maybe they all turned it down because they'd rather stay locally.
Yeah, and I think the word strategic is also key in that job title. So a strategic person typically wouldn't do the sort of performance management bit and the immediate kind of we need to make cuts now. And so I don't know how many people would have wanted that job.
Because if you've
But
been
I'm
working in
speculating.
Manchester facing the all these prospects of cuts, it might feel quite a nice change in that case to actually avoid being the one that makes these decisions and go into a nice strategy role instead.
Yes, it might well be nicer. I suppose it's perhaps not the most important job at the moment, because the most important job is sorting out the immediate financial situation, and the strategic budgets, such as population health, are being cut.
Do you think they're going to be recruiting for a new CFO? Do you think that could be down the tracks?
I don't know. Cathy Rowe is the deputy who's come into the job, and they said nice things about her in the press release. So they're sticking with her for now. But she is only interim.
All right. Thanks very much, Lawrence. I'm sure we'll talk about Greater Manchester's finances again. But let's move on to digital workforce. And Nick, you've got a leaked report, unpublished by NHS England. Shall we start with why was this commissioned and why has it never been published?
So it was commissioned in 2022 by Health Education England, but it was supported by Ruth May, who is NHS England's now outgoing chief nurse. And basically, the reason it was commissioned was because, as everyone knows, the NHS is really keen to capitalize on the opportunities within technology, which is, emerging really quickly in some areas. So it needs to transform. And of course, the largest sort of staff group in the NHS is the nurses and midwifery workforce. So if the NHS is truly to, achieve a technological transformation, it needs to make sure its staff are qualified and adept at using the technology. Currently, and this is one of the key findings of the review that I'll talk about, currently, there is a severe lack of nurses and midwives that have got good digital skills and expertise. And so the thinking was, we need to find ways of upskilling that workforce in order to make the NHS sort of ready for the all the tech which is basically coming down the line. So that's kind of the context of why it was commissioned. And then it's quite a big report. It's 56, I think, pages. It's quite detailed. They took It was led by two ladies, one from what was NHSX, Natasha Phillips, and also a representative from, I think it was the Massachusetts General Hospital in America, who's a big nurse leader over in the States. And they took a lot of input from both NHS staff, but also nurses and tech experts around the world. So it was a pretty comprehensive piece of work. It had 36 recommendations. So it's a really chunky piece of work. But as you say, it's never actually been published. It was due to be published last year, in spring 2023, which means it's now more than a year old. And from doing some sort of background research on what's going on, it doesn't seem like this review is going to be published anytime soon. So it's now been leaked to us at HSJ, and we've done quite a big story about it. And I suppose in terms of the key findings, one I already mentioned, they find that there is this big lack of skills among the nursing and midwifery workforce for technology and sort of all things digital. There are a couple of other recommendations. For example, there needs to be a competency framework set up, which will kind of set out how nurses and midwives can get their digital skills kind of embedded and train how they can be trained in them. There's lots of recommendations around student nurses and midwives and how what training they need to get in order to kind of develop these skills. And then there's also some recommendations on sort of which areas of tech nurses and midwives need to be more adept at working with, for example, things like genomics and AI. So it's a really sort of wide-ranging review, and it is an important review, but it appears to have not seen the light of day with no prospect of happening for a while.
Do you have a sense of why it was never published?
I think it so the from various conversations, there's probably two things to say. One is a sort of, I suppose, the obvious one, which is the money. Although the review doesn't put any price tag on what it would cost to implement all these recommendations, clearly it would take quite a lot of resource, because you're talking about, redesigning lots of training, I guess, pathways for student nurses and midwives. There's a whole sort of governance piece which is needed. Another important recommendation is the creation of a national board to sort of oversee the implementation of the report, and clearly that would need some resource. And of course, all this is coming at a time when, as Lawrence has just said, in man, locally and nationally in the NHS, the money is just so tight. So I think the financial requirement is probably one reason why NHS England have decided against pressing ahead with this. Another factor is also, I think, that some of the reviews sort of support, main supporters or influential supporters, they don't no longer work in the in or around the NHS. Ruth May obviously is leaving. She announced that last month. There are some people there who are still, I think, still would like to see the review published, but I think it's fallen down the very, very, very long list of priorities that, you know, the NHSE exec team has, which is a real shame because, you know, the need for the review, which I set out earlier, is sort of, you know, it makes the case, I think, quite easily, the fact that if you're going to really transform through technology, you have to get your biggest staff group on board. And so, yeah, it does, it comes back to that kind of slightly short-term decision making that although this review, it wouldn't kind of bring about any immediate improvements because obviously training takes time, you know, transforming the digital skills of an entire workforce of 100, you know, a couple of 100,000 staff is not going to be take a be an easy job and a quick job. So, but it would of course probably be really valuable in 5, 10, 15 years' time. So it's another sort of short-term decision, unfortunately, which I'm sure is just storing up more problems later on down the line.
And was there anything in it that you thought was particularly controversial or that might have gone
Yeah, I
down,
mean there
maybe
was
not
quite a,
brilliantly?
some of the recommendations I think, you know, I could certainly I thought they were seemed very, very reasonable. Others I could see being slightly more contentious. So, you know, there was a few interesting ones. For example, I suppose just to give an example of why exactly nurses, for example, should, you know, get these skills, there's a, the review is quite interesting on that. So for example, in genomics, clearly a very sort of fast growing and rapidly evolving area. The review said that within as little as 5 years, nurses and midwives are going to be offering what they call genetic counselling much more routinely for patients. So they'll be using, you know, information in the patient's genetics to help advise them on various decisions. It could be screening, it could be, you know, sort of using what they call precision medicine to help patients. Right now, there's, you know, I don't think there's a lot of knowledge of that area, but that it's coming fast. So that's one area the review said nurses really need to and midwives need to kind of be trained in this stuff. Another example was with this sort of explosion of AI that we're seeing. The review said that in as little as 5 years, patients are going to be given AI-driven bionic arms that mimic natural hand movements, and there are patients who would need that. And so, obviously, there's a huge kind of requirement for nurses to understand what that technology is going to do for the patient, how to work with the patient to help them in their treatment and recovery. And that, and so, you know, having that kind of training and understanding of AI so that you can work with the patient, but also help evaluate pilots, you know, in trust treatment pilots, or so that's going to be really important. So those two I thought were quite good examples of sort of setting out why these skills are needed. There was also a recommendation that was for all, and this one may be slightly controversial in some ways, all nurses and midwives should be given a what they call a digital passport, which sets out that person's sort of skill or digital skills there, the level of skill they have. So for example, if a nurse wasn't very well trained in the use of technology, the passport would sort of show that. It would almost be like a sort of badge which sets out how good you are at something, which might be quite intimidating to the staff, but then equally, I think it was aimed more for the benefit of employers who could then look at their workforce and understand where the skills shortage was and could then target them for more training and kind of bring the you know the workforce up to a good level of digital ability. So yeah, they're sort of some of the sort of standout recommendations, I think. And there was, you know, there's a whole host of others. I sadly we don't have time to go through all 36, but they most of them kind of seemed fairly reasonable. And when it when you're dealing with sort of fast emerging tech like the NHS, you don't have to. You would think it makes sense to sort of train your workforce, the biggest workforce, to understand what that needs and means.
That's interesting. Yeah, I can imagine that being quite controversial, as particularly older nurses might worry that they might be discriminated against if they didn't have the same skills as someone who's just kind of trained and come out of university and has.
But he also made the point that nurses and midwives at the moment, they aren't consulted enough when it comes to planning your technology spend, both within a trust and in an ICS. Obviously, there's a big push now for these decisions about where to invest your tech funding to be taken at ICS level, but there's very little, usually very little nursing or midwifery representation on, integrated care boards. There might, if you're lucky in your ICS, you might have a couple of chief nursing information officers that work in their providers, and I guess you might have a chief nurse on the ICB, but the chances of that chief nurse on the ICB also being quite skilled and adept and understanding of all the technology that we're talking about here is quite, it's quite a small chance that you might have someone with all those skills. So the review also highlighted that there's a real need for ICSs, ICBs in particular, to kind of get representation from nursing and midwifery digital experts, if you like, who could then help advise on tech priorities and spending. And I think the other thing, which I'll just mention as well to bear in mind, is that this staff group does kind of sit in a unique position in that they are the close almost they're the closest you closest to the patients. They're the people that spend the most time with patients, but they also kind of sit in that kind of operational performance area where they obviously are aware of what's happening from a kind of management point of view, what's happening on their wards and in the departments. So they sit at quite a kind of crucial intersection, and that puts them in quite a unique position where you'd think if they kind of had better understanding of the digital tools available, they would play quite a significant role in kind of understanding how tech could be used to really drive some quite meaningful changes. And at the moment, that's not really happening because there's this big lack of skills and awareness about tech.
And was there anything around that this maybe starts at university and how, or whichever route the nurse or midwife has come up through, that if you want them to have these skills and this kind of deeper understanding of technology and even AI as that becomes more widely used in the NHS, that curriculums need to change and they need to be taught in a different way?
Yes, there is some detail on it. The review does say it will, there will need to be a need to kind of not so much overhaul, but more integrate these digital agendas into the curriculum. So we're not talking about sort of completely ripping up the what nurses are being taught right now and kind of starting again. It's more of like just having a more focus on the all things tech in that training process, because at the moment I think it's very well, it seems like it's nowhere near enough sufficient. One of the examples it gives is all student nurses and midwives should be they should get access to a simulated electronic patient care record, which they can then practice putting data into about patients and using that EPR to for various things, both kind of learning the basics, but also like understanding what are the opportunities for using this data to kind of maximize the potential. So that's one example. And another important finding, I think, of the review is that obviously the NHS has this big problem about people trusting the NHS to use its data properly. Everyone, at the moment is very worried that your data is going to get misused. Clearly, nurses, as I say, they spend the most time with the patients. They actually are probably the best and they are the most trusted profession within the NHS as well, the most trusted staff group. I think surveys repeatedly show that they're the most trusted by the patients. So if you could have a nurse explaining to patients here's your data and here's what we would like to do with it, and this is why I think it's perfectly safe and you shouldn't have any concerns, you know, again, that could really contribute to quite a big change of maybe mindset, get rid of some of that skepticism that patients have when they're being asked to, you know, share the data for various research or planning initiatives. So again, it kind of I just think the business case for all this seems to write itself, but of course the trouble is it does cost money, and that's something the NHS doesn't have much of at the moment.
Yeah, and that's the problem. All right. Thanks very much, Nick, for taking us through that. And yeah, your story is online, of course, for any subscribers listening. I think on that note, time to close the podcast this week. It's been good talking to both of you. And just a reminder to listeners, if you haven't already, do subscribe to our podcast wherever you usually listen. Thanks very much, and we'll be back next week.